Welcome to Friday. Time for the Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. You're going to get a quick recap of the big news now with some personality. My guests are likable people. You have a problem with that characterization? Okay, well, my guests are people, and you decide whether they're likable. Seattle's former mayor, Mike McGinn, the editor of the Evergrey newsletter, Monica Guzman, Seattle writer, Ijeoma Oluo. Latest book is So You Want to Talk About Race, which sometimes I do. Welcome, everybody.
Hi.
Hey, hey.
Thanks for coming. Likeable or not likeable? What do you think?
Likeable enough. Isn't that what Obama had to say about Hillary? You're likeable
you
enough.
Likeable
We're likeable enough.
Okay. Just likeable enough. So over the last few years, this program has had recurring themes. Affordability, homelessness, Amazon, taxes. Four of the big ones. And this week, all those themes collide. This week, the frustrations boiled over with Amazon announcing it's pausing two projects in downtown Seattle while the city decides on a new tax, an employee head tax, on big businesses that would pay for low-income housing and services for homeless people. This tax would cost Amazon tens of millions of dollars a year. Council member Shama Sawant called Amazon's pause on their projects blackmail. But when Sawant held a rally yesterday at the Amazon Spheres, she was met by a group of iron workers, union workers, who Sawant celebrates.
Can I make an appeal to my brothers in the labor movement? As you know, I'm also a rank and file member.
No head tax!
No head tax! No head tax! No head tax!
And
no head tax!
In Ballard, no city councilor Mike O'Brien, who has championed this head tax, he got shouted down.
If property crime is committed, violence is committed, you need to call 911 and the police.
So first of all, Mike McGinn, if you were still Seattle's mayor, number one, would you support this head tax?
Yes.
Okay. Number two, what would you do, in response to Amazon's move to put some projects on hold while you go support the head tax?
You know, you have to – there's a fundamental issue here. They're throwing their weight around, and we know that. We've had a head tax before, 2009. The Chamber of Commerce threw their weight around – cowed the council, got rid of it. And they're doing it again. And they're saying, you know, they're going to move jobs. And I guess the point I'm going to make here, and this is a very fundamental point, is we can talk about jobs, but there's a deeper issue here, which is, does capitalism serve democracy, or is democracy supposed to serve capitalism? And what's going on right here is Amazon and the Chamber of Commerce believes that democracy is supposed to be there to serve them. And I think they've got the equation reversed.
Well, Microsoft, do you think Amazon has a moral obligation to pay? I put that question to Councilmember Lisa Herbold, and she said, well, I don't know about a moral obligation, but this is good business for Amazon. This is why they should support the kind of city that they want to have a headquarters in. Of course, the problem with that is then Amazon can decide whether it's in Amazon's interest, and maybe they are. Monica, any response?
I'm shaking my head right now because, honestly, did any of you see the video from that meeting, the Mike O'Brien one? The exasperation and frustration in that people have and are sharing right now, it's, you can tell, things are cutting to the bone for so many people in our city. And I'm concerned. I'm worried that we don't know quite how to engage on this right. And in the case of Amazon, it does seem like one of the philosophical questions at the foundation of all of this is, you know, how much does the second most valuable company in the world owe its hometown? What is enough? What is not? And, you know, when there are such critical red alert issues in the city, is it ever enough, really? And I'm just not sure. These things feel so raw and ragged. It's difficult to contain them and speak of them very kind of logically.
In fact, I do want to talk about raw and ragged. A little bit later, I just want to focus on this question of whether we are becoming a less civil city, as I sometimes hear from KUOW listeners. On the topic of Amazon and whether it will or ought to pay a head tax to help fund low-income housing and homeless services, Ijeoma, what was your reaction to all that debate this week?
You know, I think that a lot of people are asking whether or not, you know, Amazon should want to do this or not. But honestly, what I think is we should be looking at this city and thinking about what our priorities are. And we always do when we think about, you know, how much space we're going to give to corporations and the deals that we make with corporations. And it should be a priority for us that some of the people who have been, especially considering the amount of people who've been kind of displaced or rents that have been increased by the massive land grab that companies like Amazon have. And what we have right now are a lot of companies who come here, make a lot of money out of the area and bring people here. But the people who live here oftentimes get minimal benefit from these companies. And I really think that's up to the city to decide morally what it is and what it thinks growth is. And if you think growth is profits that really only hit, you know, the top percentage of the population or people who are coming in with advanced degrees and able to take higher positions in these companies, you think that's the growth you want for your city, then you're basically saying that you don't care about people who were here and the people who are most at risk. And I think that citizens, neighbors need to decide what they want their neighborhoods to look like and being willing to own that. And if that means that you want it to be defined by wealth that leaves other people behind, that where we don't see poor people in Seattle simply because they can't afford to live here anymore. If that's the neighborhood you want, you need to be willing to own that. But that's not what I want for this city.
Okay, I want to talk more about Amazon's fair share in a moment. Mike McGinn, you said you support this head tax, and the council members who support it, Sawant, Gonzalez, Herbold, Mosqueda, O'Brien, they say that the Seattle growth boom has fueled home prices and homelessness. So if Amazon cancels projects, isn't that good news to you? That means, by that logic, that would mean they are lowering prices and reducing homelessness by pausing these projects. Good news?
Well, you know, there's obviously a negotiation that's being played out very, very publicly right now. And what Amazon is doing is saying it wants the benefits of the city while being protected from taxes.
But they pay taxes, as you
sure
know.
Sure they do. Sure they do. But everybody knew in this last 2017 election, at least the insiders certainly knew, that this election was going to be about who pays for the costs of growth. And that's why Amazon put, I think, $350,000 into an independent expenditure campaign. So they like to talk about these races being about candidates' experiences and the like. But for Amazon, it was about its bottom line. And there was one candidate in that race who was the beneficiary of that, and that's Jenny Durkin. And she's in the hot seat right now. She's not taking a position on this. And Amazon doesn't spend $350,000 without checking what's going to happen to their money first. So it's pretty clear probably what she told them back when she was running. So there's.
But to my question, yeah. Would you say that Amazon slowing growth? Fantastic. That's the goal.
I guess what I'm trying to get at is that there's a negotiation going on and we don't know how this is going to play out. They're here for a reason. It used to be that companies set up in the suburbs because that's where the land was cheap. Now they set up in cities. Weyerhaeuser moved into town. K2 moved off of Vashon Island. Microsoft, Google, Facebook, they all have headquarters here. And it's not because it's cheap or easy to drive around. It's because the city has tremendous benefits, which attracts the people they want to hire. So Seattle has a strong negotiating position. So let's negotiate from strength and not be bullied by Amazon.
I think we have to stop treating it like an all or nothing game, right? A lot of times we do this where it's like, oh, well, would it be better than if we just left and there was no Amazon? But the truth is you can have growth that's not built on the backs of disenfranchised populations. And that's what we're trying to do here. We're saying, yes, we support Amazon. We love a lot about Amazon. And we would really love that your growth and success did not come on the backs of our most marginalized populations. We would like you to invest in that as well. We would like you as a company that loves Seattle to invest in that as well. We would like you to mitigate some of the costs for your extreme growth. And it gets frustrating for me oftentimes because we talk about this all or nothing. Oh, I'm just going to take my ball and go home. Why? That's not what it looks like when you're a partner with a community. Mm-hmm. That's not what it looks like when you care about a community. Mm-hmm. You look and say, you know what? If we are doing harm with our expansion, let's talk and see what we need to do. And that's really what we're trying to do with what this head tax attempting to do. And instead of offering up any other suggestions or trying to negotiate, Amazon is basically saying, we will take our ball and go home. And that's really not a relationship. That's not a partnership. That shows, you know, no.
They would say they'll go to some other place that wants them.
And they
are. And they'll shower all those wonderful benefits on. Those are worthy human beings in Boston or Atlanta or Toronto or wherever the next Amazon investment could be.
That's one thing that has been really interesting to watch this week, that when they said they would pause construction, they also sort of demonstrated, you know, in case it was sort of easy to forget, because I think it can be, that they do impact Seattle's economy up and down the economic ladder. And often, I think when we think of Amazon, we think of the people with 100, you know, what is it, an average of 110,000 salary in Seattle. But it turns out that, you know, when you run 20% of the office space in a city and you're building so much, there's a lot of things in the city that line up behind you. And so that threat, what they're saying that they're going to stop doing is, you know, threatening to have a short-term impact on people's livelihoods. And so that you add that into the mix. And like you said, I mean, what a dilemma. What a place to be at.
But it doesn't have to be a dilemma. That's the thing that's frustrating to me. If they go to another city, they will hold this over another city's head. And the most disenfranchised of that population will once again be put at risk. And time again, we're basically saying that Amazon doesn't think that these people are important. And the city, in making these sort, in capitulating to this, is also saying that they don't think these populations are important. And why can't we agree that a strong business that actually cares for the population that it serves, that cares for the city it's in, is good for everyone? I don't know why we can't come to that solution. I don't know why we can't honestly say that a company should not profit, that we do actually don't just value the dollars they bring in to some, but we also value the populations who are negatively impacted by this, and we will care for them. I don't understand why we can't do both. We can. But we'd like to act like this is an all or nothing debate, and it's really not.
Mike McGinn, the Chamber of Commerce says the city can't be trusted to spend its tax money efficiently. In fact, we learned last week the city undersold the cost of the transportation projects it promised in the $930 million Let's Move Seattle levy. Did the city prove it can't be trusted with tax revenue?
You know, I think there's some real challenges in the city right now. I mean, what we saw was in the boom times that our budget skyrocketed. And, you know, the politics were pretty straightforward then of, you know, just make promises, hand out money. And we're now at a situation where, you know, that lack of fiscal management is coming back to hurt the city. And one of the things, going back to Monica's comments about what's happening in Ballard, is, you know, I think part of that anger underlying that there wasn't necessarily about the head tax or homelessness, although that was a lot of it. It's people feel like the property taxes are going up and they're not being heard.
Right.
And they see the waste. So we have a really divided city right now where basically nobody feels like they're being heard.
Mm.
And that goes back to, you know, the ability of government to deal with it. Not, I don't want to put it all on city government. But when you try to do things in government by just taking the stakeholders and, you know, which are basically certain types of insiders and putting them in a room to decide things, that's a recipe for everybody else feeling left out. And I say, I don't want to blame them completely, because this huge inequity, global inequity we're seeing, is driving this locally as well. You know, so there's a lot of pressure underneath this system that the elected officials have to try to manage. But they haven't been managing it very well for the last few years, and everybody's feeling like they're not being heard.
So when you hear those folks in Ballard, for example, complaining that the city, we may have the audio later this hour, I'm not sure, but I remember a man saying that, describing the city council as being a quasi-religious organization that just will take your money and expect you to take it on faith that they know what they're doing. So where, and there's a range of reactions to that, right? That's pure selfishness and being hidebound and NIMBY and all that. And so I'm just curious around the room real quick before we move on, where what your take is on that, that Seattle kind of uprising, the Ballard shout down reaction that we're hearing more and more of.
Well, I mean, there's a small part of me that sees a strange bit of hope in the frustration, because often it's when things get down to the bone and down to the wire that the most creative solutions come out.
That's interesting.
Do you know what I mean? I mean,
maybe.
In this
so
case,
say more about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you're seeing is the structures that we have put in place that normally are able to manage these kinds of conversations are not working. And also the issues that we are facing are not technical issues that we know how to solve. Homelessness, for crying out loud. We don't know, because it does seem to require a lot more housing. I think most people agree on that. But how do you get that housing? Do you get it by changing regulations in the city? Do you get it by raising taxes and just trying to build as quickly as you can to alleviate people's pain right now? And then who has to be on the line for all of these changes, right? Like, is it the, how much is it the company that is driving a lot of the growth? How much is it the people that are lucky enough to be housed, et cetera? And these things are not things that you can just read in a headline and forget about. These things matter to your personal life. And I think that's the case for a multiple of people in Seattle who are all coming from different directions. So a little part of me did hear that meeting in Ballard and go, well, gosh, sometimes when you shout, especially when we're so Seattle nice, sometimes when you shout, you get through. Sometimes people just go, fine, what are you trying to say? Uh-huh. So there's a little part of me that's going, maybe that can happen.
Ijeoma?
You know, I live on the North End. So nothing about that meeting actually really surprised me, because Seattle is a city that wants its comfort and wants its safety and, you know, wants its privilege, and it doesn't actually want to pay for any of it, and would rather that the people who do not have that disappear. But the moment that they're asked to actually invest in it or reinvest some of the privilege they have to have that comfort, that's viewed as like a outrageous assault on their rights. And the truth is that we have people who have been suffering much more than the people shouting at that meeting for a very long time. And the argument really is do we hear them? And do we help them? And do we invest in them and see them as neighbors? Or do we only count the people who are just now afraid that they might have to give a little back to help people who have been really left out of all of Seattle's wealth and comfort for decades? And I see this all of the time living on the North End. I see a lot of these complaints about, you know, people who want to do something about homelessness but don't want to pay for it, and certainly don't want any homeless camps near their neighborhood, and, you know, don't want any methadone clinics in their neighborhood, and don't want any of the things that would help, and they don't want to pay for taxes to have, you know, permanent housing or semi-permanent housing built. They just want it gone. And then they get very angry when they're told that the way you fix this is by investing in it, and that we pay for the things that are important to us, and we pay to help the populations that are important to us. And then we see this outrage. Instead of outrage of how heartbreaking it is that in a city as well off as Seattle, we have a skyrocketing homelessness problem, that in a city as well off that we have so many generations locked out of that, we have outrage that people are being asked to be a part of the solution in this community that they claim they love.
Well, we, as you can hear, we don't have represented on this hour's panel some people who we're just talking about right now. So I'd like to hear from you if you're listening to this and saying, hey, I have a point of view here. Email us at record@kuow.org, record@kuow.org. So before we move on, last word to North Seattle resident, former Mayor Mike Begin. Do you have any different understanding of these folks who are fed up? You heard Ijeoma saying they want to be privileged and safe and don't want to pay for it.
You know, I think that I don't disagree with those. Obviously, I've taken my position. I support the head tax.
Yeah.
And I think we should invest a lot more in homeless services. And I think big corporations should pay, and we shouldn't continually put it on property taxes. And I was trying to express this earlier. There's something else going on here, which is that we have just seen the property taxes increasing, you know, steadily. And people don't feel that they have agency in how the city is spending its money, or not that they're being heard. And it is definitely true that I did town halls in every community in this city. And I remember I walked out of one in the North End where I'd just been getting yelled at about bike lanes really vociferously. And one of my staffers who lives on Beacon Hill said to me, wow, the people up here have different concerns than the people in my neighborhood, is what he said. And there's truth to that. There's truth to that. But even though it's true, you know, in a democracy, you have to figure out how to listen to people. Because
right.
If you don't, it is just getting worse and worse. I haven't seen this city this divided. And we've certainly had disagreements, but I haven't seen it this divided. Again, being driven by, you know, bigger issues than the city, but at the city level itself, you know, people are getting into their own camps and they're not listening to each other. And there is some fundamental disconnect occurring.
Right. Okay. I want to say a little more about divisions. And by the way, a relatively peaceful May Day. A little bit later in the show. Okay, let's pause there as we're going to see what happens with the Seattle City Council. Last we got an unofficial count. 5 city councilors are in favor of this head tax with 4 against and a mayor who we're wondering if it passes, would she veto it? I believe the city council is scheduled to vote on May 14. I don't know whether Amazon's announcement changes that, but we're in the middle of it. We'll see what happens. We're going to come right back with more of the Week in Review with Ijeoma Oluo, Monica Guzman, and Mike McGinn. Stay tuned. Okay, more on May Day and civility in a moment. This is the Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. I could say this is a sad story. I don't actually feel sad. It's a milestone. Ichiro, just very briefly, Ichiro's playing career apparently is over after one of the greatest careers in Major League Baseball history. 44-year-old Ichiro Suzuki stepped up to the plate in Safeco Field this week for this dramatic farewell.
Now the 1-2. 2 outs.
That was it. He struck out. Nobody knew. Nobody knew that was his final at bat. After the game, the team announced that Ichiro is transitioning to a front office job with the title special assistant to the chairman.
It feels like this is one of those where he just got here and he's leaving. And wait, like I'm not that much of a Mariners fan, I'll confess, but I actually took my time when he joined the team to be like, oh yeah, who's Ichiro? Oh, they have this guy.
And for those who don't know, he played in Japan for, I don't know, a decade or so. He was a superstar there. He comes over here, superstar. He's with the Mariners. Amazing and different. He speaks through an interpreter and he has elaborate rituals before every at bat. And he was part of Mariners' success. And he went away and that was sad. And he came back here for a swan song at age 44, and it was a very short song.
Right, and we threw a party.
We threw a party,
and it was like, now he's okay. It just seems to have fizzled.
I'm glad he came back, and I wish him the best. He's always been great, lovely, you know. And I think he always brought a lot of joy to the city. And maybe he just, I feel like maybe he just wanted to end his time here in a city that I think was good to him.
With no party.
Yeah.
They'll throw a party. There's going to be a party.
You think he's coming back?
They're going to send him out there for an at-bat. It was like Magic Johnson playing in that All-Star game after he had AIDS, right? And then he was like the MVP. Hmm. I mean, they're going to bring him back. They're going to figure
out. There's a plan.
There's a plan. They haven't figured out the plan yet, but they're bringing him back, and those tickets are going to be hot. And we'll all cheer. Maybe we should throw him a parade, too. I mean, he really was something.
There you go.
He really was something.
Yeah.
I hadn't thought about the marketing of this. Maybe, wouldn't it be even more memorable if they suddenly brought him back? Like, the Seattle Times reported that he's going to travel with the team in uniform pregame, take batting practice, shag fly balls, so people will want to come out and see that. But then the game begins. Major League rules is that he's not allowed to be in the dugout. They have taken him out of the lineup. But I don't know if they couldn't put him back in the lineup.
Sure they
what
could.
If it were a, you know, a division race or something?
And I think you're allowed to add a couple of players for the playoffs. Maybe they'll bring him in for a bunt or something. You know,
all right.
A runner along. They'll figure it out.
Okay, let's figure out whether this town has become uncivil, and if so, whether that's a good or a bad thing. A relatively civil May Day, a who's got to pay for the waterfront park, and more as we continue on the Week in Review. Okay, the Week in Review continues on KUOW with Ijeoma Oluo, author of So You Want to Talk About Race, Mike McGinn, former mayor of Seattle, Monica Guzman, co-founder of the Evergrey newsletter. Earlier, we played a little audio of Seattleites being raucous, which we didn't used to be known for. Here is some more sound from this week's public hearing that we referenced in Ballard on the proposed big business employee head tax.
Blaming poor people for what's going on is like blaming Syrian refugees for ISIS. Amazon is ISIS.
Amazon is ISIS. And then there's this.
We're going to build some housing, and that costs money. So who are we going to take the money from? I'll tell you who. Say we need $5 billion. That's a pretty conservative estimate. $5 billion is how much Jeff Bezos made in 10 minutes when Amazon announced they bought Whole Foods. We're going to tax that motherfucker.
Oh, my Lord.
And one more piece of audio from that meeting.
It's refreshing to see ordinary citizens revolting against this lousy city council, this quasi-religious organization that tells us how we're supposed to think, what we're supposed to do with our money.
Also this week, the Seattle Times ran a column by a man who's lived here 14 years and has had enough of what he calls Seattle's, quote, toxic politics. He's moving to the east side, and he writes, slowly but surely, Seattle has become an angry place. And I hear this sometimes from Seattle listeners as well, that we're not only getting crowded like New Yorkers, we're rude like New Yorkers. Are you bothered by this? Is anyone bothered by Seattle's lack of or loss of civility?
I mean, I think when he says civility, he means silence. He's bothered by the lack of silence that Seattle had around the disparity and the injustice in the area. He wants to go to the east side where it's still pretty quiet and those who are suffering don't really have platforms to speak out on it. He wants to go where he can ignore what's always been happening in this city. And he'll fit in well there.
That was pretty strong. I think there are real disagreements. There are real issues here. How do we house the homeless? Who pays?
You've been you've been at polite city council meetings, and you've been at raucous ones. And yeah, I'm curious your take, former mayor.
I was alluding a little bit to this earlier. You know, I know from the races I've been in, there's a lot of talk about what's the experience of the candidate? Are they nice? How do they work well with others? But that's not what drives the campaign donations. People have agendas, real agendas. In my case, there were people that wanted to see a multi-multi-billion-dollar tunnel built and others who didn't. That's a real policy difference. There are people who now want to build a $1.7 billion convention center. And there are now people who want to impose a tax on the most successful corporations in town to pay for homelessness. These are real issues. And people are going to argue over them. And that's not a lack of civility. That's, it can be accompanied by a lack of civility. But the fact that we're arguing over really important and tough issues, let's not confuse the two.
And Monica, you cover a lot the reaction that newcomers have here, adjusting to the city, long-timers making comparisons, newcomers comparing to wherever they're from. So outside of the realm of a city council hearing, what do you think about how... I've been here so long that I don't know if I have perspective anymore. What do you think of Seattle nice or the lack of it?
Yeah, I think to Ijoma's point, I think we're living in a paradox because both there's new voices and more expression and more people speaking out who ought to. And there's also sort of different and new groups of people who aren't feeling heard. And somehow both of those things are happening at once. And expectations are changing, norms are changing.
Who's not being heard? Who feels they're not being heard?
I think at this point, almost everyone, right? Because people who are finding their voices in this very, mobilized time, there's still a long way to go, right? Before the changes that they're looking for can happen. And then you have people who love Seattle a certain way and this is what they've fallen in love with. And they're seeing the city change to a place where, maybe if you have a car and you want to get to downtown and everywhere else, that's going to get a lot harder. And you're going to have to think about transit. And, your property taxes are going to go up and housing is even more expensive. But also, there's this homelessness crisis. And what are we going to do about that? And so neighborhoods are changing. Everybody's sort of, idea of what Seattle is changing. Newcomers are kind of coming into this and going, whoa, because a lot of newcomers are getting the stigma of going toward Amazon if they're coming into Amazon and they're seeing that Amazon is both the driver of growth that is good, but also the monster that has transformed Seattle. And again, I just think we're living in these really interesting paradoxes. So how do you help people kind of navigate that? And how do we make our way through them?
I have lived in Seattle since I was 2 years old. I am 37. So I grew up on government programs in low-income housing. I slept in cars. I grew up without food. I grew up eating in churches. I grew up standing in line in food banks. I spent a lot of time in community with people who spent their entire lives cast out, overlooked, and cut off from all of this growth and prosperity in the city. I have existed for 37 years. Other people have existed in this city much longer. And the way that we have been invisible up until now was not civility. And I think we have to understand that. That's barbarous, that you would have as much wealth in this city and we would have multiple generations of people continuously cut out. And now that they're talking about it, and now that we are talking about what we're going to do, we call this incivility. Incivility was the thought that you could step over people who were suffering and say nothing. That's incivility. And that's what I suffered under growing up. And that is what so many people in Seattle suffer under.
Have you ever lived someplace else that's a model for real civility?
You know, I don't know if I've lived...
I guess you say you grew up in
Seattle. I grew up here. I've lived here for 35 years.
Traveled, friends. I mean, I guess I'm wondering, where's the not Seattle model of civility?
I don't know if there's a city that's the model, because, I mean, part of power structures reinforces this. But I would say that I have definitely been in community, right? In neighborhoods, and, you know, in neighborhoods in California, in majority-minority neighborhoods that are working together to care for community and trying to overcome these systemic barriers. And I also see these communications that are happening in Seattle and communities of color as we've been struggling for decades to try to care for each other, even though all of us have, you know, lessened access to privilege and resources. And we've been having these conversations and we have decided that we are trying our best not to leave our own behind. But the rest of the city doesn't see us as a part of the city. And I think that if you want to see what it looks like, look at the communities who are still somehow clinging to life, even though the city has completely overlooked them, because people have been doing the work in Seattle for a long time. And no one notices that. You know, we have plenty of projects, whether or not, you know, it's Africa Town and the new Liberty Bank building coming up, where, you know, people who have been leaders and elders in our communities who are saying that even though everything is working against us, we're going to try to preserve community, we're going to try to look out for each other, find them. They're doing the work and they're doing it without any help and any resources.
Here's a tweet we just got from a listener. It says, "Stop at KOW. Wednesday's meeting was an anomaly. Quit giving the extremists a voice." Hmm. Anomaly? Any reaction, Mike McGinn?
Interesting. Well, you know, this discussion about civility. I mean, I think we have this ideal of government, right? That everybody will be heard. There'll be a process by which all voices will be heard, and then a rational decision will be made about what's best for everybody. I mean, that's the ideal and the promise of democracy. The practice of democracy is one in which people fight for and work for their agenda, and they work through it through the electoral process. It's not an accident that elections in this city are not the same year as presidential elections. You can go back in history. It was an intentional move 100 years ago to try to reduce the number of people that voted by holding city elections in off years. Me and Knut could write an article about this one day, right? And it's not an accident that Amazon spent $350,000 on an independent expenditure campaign to elect Jenny Durkin. They weren't interested in a dialogue about what was best for everybody. They were interested in electing a candidate who would hold the line against corporate taxes. They knew what was coming.
Well, there is a democratic dialogue we're having about,
sure,
about taxes.
Yeah, and they knew also that they did not have, as they had under me, the Chamber of Commerce, you know, had 7 of the 9 council members who they had endorsed. They didn't win every issue. They'd lost that power. So that was why it was so important for them to really come in hard on the mayor's office. So people come in with an agenda, and power decides things, not a civil discussion. And oftentimes, and I'm going to concur with Ajoma here, the civility discussion is used to distract people from the merits of the conversation, to try to claim that somebody who's raising an important issue is behaving improperly, instead of raising an important issue that needs to be discussed.
And that includes the shouting, the The shouting's okay in your book. You got something to say, you might as well shout.
Incivility is not okay. We should, in fact, listen to each other.
Okay.
We should, in fact, have a rational discussion about what's best. But let's not let these discussions about, you know, incivility detract us from the fact that there are true underlying differences of opinion.
Okay.
And again, right. The city, we're perched, like every city is right now, we're perched on top of a volcano of discontent. I realize that's a strong phrase, but we've seen it nationwide with the election of Trump. You know, income inequality, you know, racism, anti-immigrant sentiment. These are powerful, powerful forces, and we're not immune from them here in Seattle as good as we feel about our progressive city. We're far from immune. We're facing those same pressures here.
Okay.
And it's bubbling up everywhere, and we got to figure out how to deal with it, frankly, and it would be better if we could deal with it with civility than incivility, but let's not be surprised if people get angry.
Yeah, exactly. I'm less concerned about people being civil or not than I am if that people can actually express what they really feel. And this goes to all sides, you know, to the person who tweeted their point, right? You know, let's be honest. There's a set of opinions that one can hold in Seattle that one will be sort of applauded for. Mm-hmm. And there's a set of opinions that often in the mainstream conversation you will not be applauded for. Now, the piece from the man who said he's leaving after 14 years falls into the latter category. And when I found it, one of the Evergrey's more conservative readers sent it to us, which is how we, you know, saw that it had really resonated with a lot of people here. And I think that's really important to pay attention to, that it is fairly rare these days, you know, to hear a diversity of perspectives in Seattle of a certain type. And you know, I mean, I know because I hear it, a lot of conversations where people are honest about what they really think is going on in Seattle are happening in whispers and in small groups. And as a city, we can't engage those thoughts and feelings and ideas unless they reach the mainstream conversation. So that's where I think Alex has a really interesting point, that what is the culture of Seattle doing? You know, what is it out to do? And are we able to listen to a variety of perspectives? Does that remain a goal, right? And how do we put ourselves in the kind of space where we hear different perspectives without necessarily vilifying or jumping to conclusions or things like that? And I think we can all see it happening in Seattle more often, the reactions versus the thoughtful reflections.
One place the frustrations that Mike McGinn referred to bubble up annually in Seattle is on May Day. And a May Day came and went on Tuesday, with one arrest, hundreds of people demonstrating around immigrant rights, worker rights, Patriot Prayer, and the Proud Boys, and they didn't hurt each other. No serious property damage. One guy got arrested for throwing a rock at an Amazon sphere. So do you credit our enlightened decorum? Do you credit the giant police presence? Just luck. What was your take on May Day? Or was it a missed opportunity? Was May Day a, what do you think?
I mean, yeah, to me, it just felt like it feels less special because every day is May Day in a lot of ways. Uh-huh. I remember when I first got to Seattle as a journalist, one of the first assignments I had that first year was to cover the May Day protests, right? And at that year, it was the only day of the year that people talked about immigrant rights, you know?
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about that all the time now because it's incredibly pressing for all the reasons. So it just, yeah, I mean, if it's lost its luster, I don't think it's because the issues it represents have lost their urgency, but actually the opposite. The issues have become so urgent that they need a heck of a lot more than one day. And it's gotten to the point where, you know, if you look at Facebook, the number of people that say they're interested in May Day March versus the Women's March versus the Science March versus the, you go on and on and on. I mean, it just didn't compete the way it used to, right? It doesn't have all the attention. But again, I don't think that's because the issues are any less urgent.
Yeah, I would say, I mean, I'm not going to make a big analysis over one year. and how many people showed up. I think that these things go in cycles. I mean, I would love to see, you know, Seattleites coming out in force for a lot of very serious issues. And I think we have been coming out in force more these past couple of years. But I think we're also doing a lot of work, you know, trying to do a lot of work behind the scenes and with organizations and things like that. I just think that right now, energies are kind of refocused into some other areas. I also think, too, that, you know, it's been a really difficult couple of years as someone who has been in Black Lives Matter marches and various marches in the city. The fatigue of that huge police presence does not help at all. And also, you know, the fatigue as well of knowing that now we've got Proud Boys showing up and things like this. And so, you know, I think
Proud Boys are a right wing group.
Right.
Yeah.
Came around on May Day. Yeah.
You know, try to tear up some signs, things like that. And the truth is I think that, you know, a lot of times we are being more specifically issues focused right now. And so as those issues arise, we're coming up with them. It doesn't mean that next year May Day won't be huge or it might be small again. But I just would love to see more regular resistance. For me, you know, a march is great if it fires people up into action. And I just want to see people more focused on everyday action.
You've lived through some May Days, Mayor McGinn.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it's nice to see that there wasn't violence and in these events. And I think that was a tactic that was used to attract attention. It was driven by a relatively small group compared to the other thousands marching that day. And the police, you know, there was this, you know, game that was played for the benefit of the media by both sides there. You know, it was really about who was going to win the media fight as who was more restrained and who was behaving better or the like. And both sides lost that game, I think. I think that both the police, you know, rarely won that fight. And I think that the individuals who were using the cover of crowd to break windows, you know, have lost that game, too, at least in at the moment. But I also think Ajom is right that, you know, these things move in cycles and who knows where it will surface again in the future.
Coming up on The Week in Review, funny or not funny, the White House Correspondents Association dinner. Stay tuned. KUOW's Week in Review with Mike McGinn, Ijeoma Oluo, Monica Guzman. I'm Bill Radke. The White House Correspondents Association dinner happened early this week, and the comedian that they hired this time around, Michelle Wolf, she got in trouble for allegedly mocking the way women look. Here's an example.
Mitch McConnell isn't here tonight. He had a prior engagement. He's finally getting his neck circumcised.
Oh.
Mazel.
Okay. That wasn't the one. This must be the one where Michelle Wolf criticizes a woman's appearance.
Republicans are easy to make fun of. You know, it's like shooting fish in a Chris Christie.
No, that was about a man's looks. Here it is. This is her joke about Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the White House spokesperson.
I actually really like Sarah. I think she's very resourceful. Like, she burns facts. And then she uses that ash to create a perfect smoky eye. Like, maybe she's born with it. Maybe it's lies. Probably lies.
Smoky eye, which I had to look up on the web. I had no idea what that was a reference to. Yes. Was she famous for her smoky eye makeup? It was completely, I had missed that one. But yet there was sure a lot of attention to what the comedian said about a White House spokesperson's either she said it about her makeup or she didn't at all. She was making a joke about her lying for a living. Help me through this. Funny or not funny?
I mean, it was blisteringly funny.
Yes.
And the arguments against it are completely disingenuous. No one is up in arms. I mean, these senators are not up in arms that Sarah's eye makeup was made a joke, like, and not even made a joke as if she didn't even say it was bad. She said it was a nice smoky eye, which
that's right.
It isn't, by the way.
Makeup,
and it is a very bad smoky eye.
I didn't know that.
But it's not even a smoky eye. I think she just, like, puts makeup on, and then the pressure of having to lie all day makes it smear everywhere.
There we go again.
And the truth is that it's just an excuse because what she did, the real offense, is that she called this administration a liar that hates the truth and hates the press. And it's That's true. But they can't say they can, that's not what they can focus on. Right. They feel like we can all gather around because for some reason we find the idea that we would joke about someone's eye makeup more offensive than the fact that we have an administration that lies multiple times a day to the American public and spends all of their time trying to undermine the press. We find that far less offensive than we find a joke about a woman's bad eye makeup. And that says a lot about the priorities, and it says a lot about how easily distracted we can be. It was a wonderful point.
How about this? Offensive or not offensive? Funny or not funny?
You guys gotta stop putting Kellyanne on your shows. All she does is lie. If you don't give her a platform, she has nowhere to lie. It's like that old saying, if a tree falls in the woods, how do we get Kellyanne under that tree? I'm not suggesting she gets hurt, just stuck. Stuck under a tree.
So I think here's the thing. I think that everybody listening to these jokes, whether you were in that room or not, you know that it's not really all in good fun. You know it's not. I think that the groans and the boos you hear on that tape are not just a reaction to the joke as text. It's a reaction to the climate, right? We know that we're an incredibly partisan time right now. We know we're out for blood, that there's people on both sides that are out for blood. And so
what does that mean? Is Michelle Wolf out for blood?
No, well, I think that people on both sides are feeling incredibly exasperated with the other side. And I think that I think that White House Correspondents' Dinner a few administrations ago, you could make a joke that seemed crass and everyone would laugh because there was a sense of, oh yeah, it's all in good fun.
The stakes were lower.
But there's some seriously strong feelings going on right now and very high stakes for a lot of people. And so, yeah, it's not in good fun.
Well, this makes you wonder then what the ideal comedian would be at a White House Correspondents' Dinner. In 1968, the host was Richard Pryor. And believe me, we looked all around for audio of that evening. If it's there, I couldn't find it. Please send it to me. But 1968, Richard Pryor. Any guesses who hosted the following year, 1969?
69, nope.
Here's a bit.
Hello, everybody. We're mighty glad to meet you here at the Golden Horseshoe.
The 1969 White House Correspondents Association Dinner Entertainment was the Disneyland Golden Horseshoe Review. What did Richard Pryor do? I want to know. Please send me that audio.
At the Golden Horseshoe Cafe, we are proud to introduce Miss Betty Taylor.
I don't know. Is that Elizabeth Taylor?
You know,
Betty Taylor might
I
be.
Would, just, I think, just I think it's important to remember, too, like a lot of the discomfort was because she was talking to press that hasn't said nearly enough about the assault on the press that Trump has had and the lies that he says. So she's basically shaming them. She's saying what they've been too cowardly to say. And as a writer, as someone who sometimes is called a journalist, we have a responsibility to be talking about the truth. And she was the only one up there saying that these are lies. Yesterday, there was a New York Times headline saying that Trump reversed his position on whether or not he paid off this woman. That's not what reversing your position is, unless he was reversing his position on how he felt about telling the truth about paying this woman, right? That's what our journalism's doing. And then we had a comedian up there saying, hey, she's lying. Y'all are buying it. And they're shamed for it.
Got about a minute left. Mike McGinn, final thoughts?
Well, a couple of things. It's hard for me to get too worked up about that dinner. I mean, we all know that if you use humor, you can usually get to say more truth often. And that's the point of this, is that this is a venue in which people can be a little more truthful if they sugarcoat it in humor, or maybe not sugarcoat it so much. The other thing is the Republicans have both houses of Congress and the presidency, and somehow they're the victims about a joke about Smokey Eye. I mean, I'm just having a hard time buying the victimization thing here. Mm-hmm. And finally, the media just loves covering itself. So, I can't get too excited about this whole issue. It's just run-of-the-mill stuff.
Are you excited about boating season opening tomorrow? That totally snuck up on me.
Whoa.
For you newcomers, you're not allowed to be in a boat from October through April. Marine Patrol will open fire on you and sink your vessel. So boating season opens officially tomorrow. The parade of the boats and the crew race through the Montlake Cut. Montlake Bridge closed 10 to 4. No matter what else is going on, that's another annual thing you do. You say Montlake Bridge will be closed 10 to 4.
I don't think we should have boat lanes if it shuts down lanes for cars. That's wrong.
War on boats.
Yeah, let's see how that goes.
Hey, thanks for coming, everybody.
Yeah.
The Week in Review on KUOW Seattle. And my guests have been Seattle writer Ijeoma Oluo. Her latest book is So You Want to Talk About Race. Monica Guzman is the editor, co-founder of the Evergrey, both, the Evergrey newsletter. Mike McGinn used to be the mayor in this town. Miss it?
Of course I do. It was an awesome job, but I love Seattle still.
We love you too. We're going to be right back on Monday with The Record. So thanks for tuning in.